This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. If you enjoy this podcast, consider going to DecodingTV.com, become a paid member, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and also bonus episodes that we will record for DecodingTV.com. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
This is unacceptable. Peering into ladies' private quarters? It's not proper! Worse than that, it's vulgar! Unholy perversion!
Hello, everyone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen, and joining me, as always, Patrick Klepek. How's it going today?
I'm going to do the intro again, and then again, and then again, and then I'll let you know when you've done it enough, David.
You like that clip, Patrick Klepek, from the,
I do.
The show? Yeah, it's a fun one. It's a fun one. Anyway, that was a clip from Shogun, which is what we're going to be covering today on Decoding TV, along with a bunch of other things. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and find us across all platforms at Decoding TV. Today on the podcast, got a lot of stuff to cover. We have a bunch of television news to discuss, and then we're going to be covering Shogun Episode 3 tomorrow and tomorrow. And also, I didn't mention this on last week's podcast, but I did put it in the show notes, that today we're going to be covering the first episode of The Regime, a new show on HBO starring Kate Winslet. So we'll be discussing that at the end of the podcast as well. But first, Patrick Klepek, our schedule has been, I'm going to say, challenging. Lately, this is our eighth episode of Decoding TV, so we've been doing this for about 2 months, and part of the goal of doing a weekly podcast is to have a consistent time each week to record it. That has basically not happened for a variety of reasons. First of all, I went to Sundance for like a week or so, and then that disrupted our schedule, and then I went to Vegas to do a trip, play some poker tournaments. And then for the last couple weeks, I have had jury duty, which has forced me to cancel all my recordings during the day and record at night instead. And so it's really kind of changed when we've recorded and when episodes release. But Patrick Klepek, the jury duty is finally over as of 3 hours ago. It was
not just collapsing into a heap on the ground.
I am tired. We had 2 days of deliberations, and I was the what's called presiding juror, which means I was helping to moderate the conversation. When the sort of opportunity came up to select a presiding juror, I raised my hand and I said, "Hey, I basically argue with people for a living."
I'm a podcast host. I could do this.
I can do this, exactly. But yes, I was moderating the convo, and it was like 2 full days of straight up deliberations, and I am really, really tired. But the good news is that that's over now, and we can resume the more important task in our society, talking about TV shows.
You know, all crime is settled. David Chen is weighed in, where society is prepared to move on.
There is, you know, the matter of whether or not, you know, such and such and so gets charged with a crime or, you know, gets found guilty of a crime. And also what we think about Kate Winslet's new show. Though, you know, of those two, I'm pretty sure we all know what is more important for society. So anyway. I will say, very odd, Patrick Klepek, to participate in this, like, you know, 8 to 9 day event with people, like spend, you know, dozens of hours with them in an extremely intense, on an extremely intense task. And then you say goodbye and you probably will never see each other again. You know what I mean? Like, that's just like a weird thing to go through, you know?
Is like, there's no way to, like, hey, I liked how you argued that point. We should, like, go get coffee sometime. There's no opportunities for, like, a sharing of information.
I'm sure it's possible, and I'm sure friendships do form from people who go to jury duty, but I think, like, by the end of that, you know, here's what I'll say. I was the foreperson, and I was, you know, moderating the conversation. And I at one point, I said to everyone, hey, I think everyone's doing a great job. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, everyone's engaged, and they're bringing their thoughtful and attentive selves, and people are showing up on time. And I said, you know, I think this has been an extraordinary experience. And somebody said, well, it's been an experience.
Well, bam!
So that's how much they wanted to be friends with me, Patrick Klepek, after the fact.
I can't tell if that was a judgment on you or reflection of the conversation. You know, who could say?
Indeed. Well, anyway, even though Patrick Klepek is taking vacation in a couple weeks, at some point in the near future, we do expect to be on a more regular
by
schedule.
April. We'll be able to record at a normal
April
time.
Of 2025, we'll be on a regular schedule. On that note, there have been some questions and concerns about the new format of the show. A lot of praise, a lot of support as well. But I think there is one big question about, like, how exactly are we going to cover... When we give homework, what can people expect from us? And I think Patrick and I were talking about this before the show, and there's three categories of our coverage of show, essentially, right? There is shows that we will cover week to week. Mm-hmm. So Shogun is one of those shows. We will have a pretty detailed recap and review of every single week's episode of Shogun, because we're like, we love the show. It's a deep show. There's a lot to discuss. There's shows where we will watch, like, Constellation and talk about the first couple episodes, and then we'll maybe do a bonus episode at the end after the show has finished airing. But we will not cover it week to week. And then there are shows that we will cover the first episode or two and then probably never talk about again. And we will try to make clear which type of show it is when we cover it on that week's episode. So those are the kind of three forms of coverage that we're going to take. Right, Patrick? Did I catch that correctly? Did I summarize that well?
I guess, you know, small asterisk, we reserve the right to add Regime or other show at the last second. I mean, it's one of those things where we're trying to balance between, you know, all of you listening wanting to, like, be your most prepared selves for however much. Some people just want to listen to a conversation, not actually watch the show. Some people want to watch all of the show and, like, be very and so we're just trying to find a way so that we can be more communicative. At the end of the day, though, what we want to do is, like, make the best podcast, facilitate the best conversation, and sometimes we'll veer from that format, but I think that's kind of what's taking shape as David and I have figured out, like, what shows we like, which make the best discussions, and that'll obviously change going forward, but I think that's where we're kind of settling into a cadence at the moment.
Yeah. I'm feeling like there'll be, like, one or two shows that we cover week to week, and then one or two shows that we kind of dip in on, basically, each weekend to be like, here's the first couple episodes of this show, and so forth. And that feels good to me. That feels like that's a solid plan, because we can't cover... It's not practical to do, like, four shows week to week recap. That doesn't make sense. But we also want people to be able to hear about new shows that are premiering each week. So... we're trying to find the balance. Of course, if you have any feedback for any of this, decodingtv@gmail.com. I will probably also, like, maybe at some level, at some point, Patrick, we can give a name to each of those tiers. Like, we're covering, we're giving this show the gold tier treatment. And well, that means we'll cover week to week. Or silver means we'll have a bonus episode at the end. And bronze is whenever, we'll never speak of it again. Who knows? but yeah, open to any feedback at decodingtv@gmail.com. And we just want people to know what to expect from us. That's one of the priorities. All right, Patrick Klepek, I do want to start by talking about some television news today. Here's a big piece of news. Shogun, the season premiere, got 9 million views globally across Hulu, Disney Plus, and Star Plus in its first days of availability. Reading here from a Variety article that this is now FX's biggest Hulu premiere, beating The Bear Season 2. Patrick Klepek, the monoculture is back, baby.
I don't know if 9 million gets us to a monoculture, but
the monoculture is back.
But it is, it's more than I expected. I mean, you know, when one of the as great as this show is, as much as I'm enjoying it and I'm excited to keep talking about it with you and the rest of the Decoding TV audience, you know, like one of the conversations we had about it last week with Jesse Earle was like the way it handles language, right? Like, this is a show that's got some English, but it's a lot of reading subtitles. There doesn't seem to be, well, we know, I mean, we know this because of it's an adaptation of a work we're already familiar with, but like, there aren't dragons around the corner. It's not using historical trappings to then bring in something sci-fi or supernatural. Like, it is a historical epic done exceptionally well for what we've watched so far. It, can that be a hit? Like, it's missing a lot of the kind of high concept work that we often see associated with like the biggest of shows. And so I'm delighted that Shogun has hit as well as it has. And if it's hitting this hard early on, hopefully all I keep seeing is good word of mouth from friends telling friends that, as we saw with True Detective, right? I don't think this is going to go that route. I have a higher confidence a couple episodes in that there's a stronger like foundation of storytelling. It's also taking from an existing work, and so that's certainly helpful as well.
It was really weird seeing all those deer run away from from the samurai in episode one of Shogun. That was
bizarre. So scared of all the diving at the end of this episode. but I'm hoping it's going to have that sort of that snowball effect. Like, more people are going to get into this show, and I'll be curious if it manages to continue getting that going forward, because it seems well suited and set up to have that kind of momentum as the show goes along.
Excuse me. What has the word of mouth for Shogun been like in your social circles? Because I will tell you, from my perspective, I am the annoying guy telling everyone you have to watch Shogun. Right? But have you gotten the text from someone that says, hey, Patrick, you got to watch Shogun, or, you know, and then you've had to have the awkward conversation. I actually do a TV podcast and we talk about Shogun each week. You know, has anyone in your social circle talked about it?
Yeah, not IRL, not in real life. But so many of my like in real life friends are also parents, in which like it's an even harder sell. But I think where I've noticed it is in my online social circles, where it just like, I feel like every day, a couple of times through some sort of Discord or other like social media platform, someone writes, holy shit, like Shogun slaps, or like some version of that. It just feels like enough people are getting activated on the show slowly week after week. And part of that's the bonus of a show like going week to week, is that I think if everything dropped at once, you're staring down the barrel of 10 episodes, you've missed the conversation. 2-3 episodes in, there's still an opportunity to be like, I've got 2 or 3 hours I can carve out over the next like week and a half and catch up. And I think this show is going to be able to have that bandwagon effect. But I am like you, that annoying person where you're catching up, you know, with somebody on a Friday night, and it's like, what are you up to? Watching Shogun? How about you? And like, not watching Shogun, but you're going to hear me talk about it for a little bit.
Indeed. All right. I wanted to mention a couple of pickups and cancellations. The Brother's Son, this is a big one. The Brother's Son canceled by Netflix after one season. Pretty shocking. This was a very well-reviewed show that was frequently in the Netflix top 10. I saw, I think, Mike Royce tweeting that, you know, Mike Royce, the screenwriter and producer who has been responsible for Everybody Loves Raymond, and he tweeted like, I don't understand this. Like, I don't get this. This is a show that wasn't particularly expensive. It was popular. It was well reviewed and canceled after one season. I really feel like it's just reinforcing the narrative that Netflix doesn't know how to continue shows after three seasons. And that's, and you know, this didn't even get to season two. And I think it does have a corrosive effect on people deciding whether or not to get into a Netflix show. You know, they have seen so many of these cancellations that they're like, you know what? I'm just going to wait a couple years. And then it becomes this vicious circle where people wait and then the show doesn't get as many ratings, and then the show gets canceled, and then some more people wait the next time around. Patrick Klepek, do you have any of these these kind of streaming shows or Netflix shows canceled that haunt you by any chance?
Well, it's less shows in particular as much as I absolutely fall into the cycle that you're talking about, where I saw the Brother Son, like, well reviewed, like, oh, like, I love Michelle Yeoh. Like, I'll get around to that. Didn't get around. Like, but like, it's not like I didn't get around to it. We're not 5 years removed from the show, and I go, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't watch it. Like, this is a recent
show. Less than 3 months ago, right?
Yeah, we're not even talking a year later where you're wondering, yeah, when's season two dropping? Oh, yeah, they decided not to renew. Like, it feels, right. In some ways, I'm hoping there's a different shoe to drop with this show that would, like, better help me understand what happened here, because you end up feeling guilty for not watching show, like, should I just, like, put it on? Like, Netflix doesn't have a
just
camera.
Set it on repeat. Like, get that viewer retention time going up. You know, yeah.
Because I think part of what's frustrating about this specific show and its cancellation is just as you mentioned with before, like, what bucket does this fall into? A lot of times when these shows get canceled, it's like, oh, obviously expensive, like, serial storytelling show. It's frustrating that they're not going to wrap things up for the three seasons that it was, like, very clearly they had planned. Like, but a lot of those shows are expensive, take a long time to make. And that's not to say there wasn't talent, time, resources, love, blood, sweat, tears putting into making this show. But it's like you said, if it's, like, pretty popular, didn't cost that much, well-liked, what the fuck else can you do to get a second season? And I guess that's why I try and hold out hope that there is some other explanation, even if we don't end up learning it, because it's like you've checked all the boxes, like, to the best of your ability of what's expected to be, like, what did you expect the show to be? Like, I don't know. I think that part is frustrating, where even you as the viewer can't quite understand your relationship with the service you pay for and how your viewing habits do or don't influence, you know, the thing that comes next. It used to be pretty transactional. I pay you, I watch the thing, enough people do that, yay, you know, it goes on. And even here, we have, much like a box office, like, numeric, you know, we don't see numbers attached to that in the same way that we get, like, you know, you can go to a Box Office Mojo or something like that and see the raw numbers and how that stacks up against marketing spends. But like you said, like, this spent meaningful time in the top 10. It just kind of baffles how a show like this can't make it over the finish line.
Agreed. Well, The Brother Son got canceled after one season at Netflix. We also heard the Neuromancer TV adaptation is a go at Apple, with Graham Roland going to serve as showrunner. Neuromancer, based off the classic William Gibson novel, this was attached to Vincenzo Natali for a really long time. Vincenzo Natali, the guest on this week's episode of the Filmcast, by the way, for our Dune 2 review. And people have been trying to bring this to the screen for forever. And now it's finally happening. It's based on the 1984 novel, Gibson's novel. And the creator of Dark Winds and Graham Roland and J.D. Dillard will be sort of handling the TV version of the show. Pretty exciting. Pretty exciting to see kind of this classic book brought to the small screen. And I think it will, you know, probably a TV format will suit it better than a theatrical version, but we'll see what happens. Couple of big pieces of show news right at the top of the podcast for you. On that note, we also heard a little bit more about The Rings of Power, Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. The showrunners of that show have signed on to a 3-year deal with Amazon, which also launches their own production company, 1040 PM Studios. The news also dropped along with this that the show's second season has wrapped filming and will be released later this year. A third season hasn't officially been ordered and a writer's room has not yet opened, but the showrunners have started to break the initial story outline. Patrick Klepek, The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, was a show we covered week to week here on Decoding TV, but you were not part of the podcast at that time. What did you think of The Rings of Power?
I was pretty skeptical going into it, but found that it was a show, so, you know, that came out the same summer as House of the Dragon season one, I think aired concurrently, like more or less premiered, like in the same window, got swept away by, you know, House of the Dragon, just found that it was too much to watch two kind of like high fantasy shows at once. But then my wife is just the quintessential Tolkien Lord of the Rings nerd and was like, we got to get back to that show. And I was like, okay, you know, that first episode, you know, didn't do a lot for me, but sure, we'll go with it. And I found I got much more into the show as it went along. I thought that it really kind of found its footing, more of its own identity. And the storytelling had a real swiftness to it, especially in the back half, that I found myself actually awfully excited for the second season in a way that I wouldn't have anticipated from the start. So I'm super interested to see what they managed to do. And I'm glad that, whether it was the writer's strike or production schedules, who knows? I'm also just glad that the shows don't have to overlap with one another and can have like a summer and a fall to themselves. Because I understand the overlapping and the kind of complementary nature to those shows, but I'm glad they can kind of just kind of exist on their own. But yeah, I was genuinely a fan.
The overlapping nature of which shows, Patrick Lepik?
House of the Dragon and Rings of Power.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That was a very hard time of my life when I was we were doing the podcast covering those shows. But those who are longtime listeners of Decoding TV know I was not a big fan of Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. I actually had the complete opposite journey of you. I thought it started fine and then ended kind of catastrophically. Like, I just watched the David Lynch Dune movie, the Kyle MacLachlan one that David Lynch has disowned. And the storytelling of The Rings of Power really kind of reminds me of the storytelling in that David Lynch Dune movie, where they're just like, hey, let's just throw a bunch of shit in, cram it all together into like the last few episodes. And I did not love the show. And also, by the way, I should point out that apparently people didn't love the show too much either. There are shows like True Detective Night Country and I assume Shogun where they open big and then they get bigger, right? That's True Detective Night Country, Shogun, I assume. And then there's shows that open big and then get smaller over time. And according to the stats we have, Lord of the Rings was one of those shows. I think it had something like only 60% of people, if I recall correctly, 59% of people, 60% of people.
I'd be so curious.
Got to the final episode of Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, right?
I'd be curious if it gets any momentum with the second season, or maybe that's hard to recapture given how much initial interest there was. But I do think it is a very common story, the one that I just told you, which was I watched the opening episodes of both those shows, and I chose a path. And the path was House of the Dragon. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to watch two of these fantasy shows at the exact same time. And so maybe that'll end up being part of the story, is that House of the Dragon was a better show and captured the moment. And Rings of Power can't do that. But I guess that's part of my point of being glad that there's a bit of separation between the two, because sure, I do think it was impossible to not constantly compare the ratings, the interest, the storytelling of those two shows. And I think that's not to take away from your very legitimate criticisms of how that show was told, but I do think that just ended up being like a real paradox and a problem for both of those shows.
I don't even think it's close between those two, man. I think it's like watching someone perform a Rachmaninoff concerto versus somebody playing chopsticks. Like, that's kind of the difference in storytelling quality. Like, House of the Dragon is, I have some complaints about it, but it is a legitimately brilliant, great, genre-defining show.
I'm with you that they are on different planes of quality in storytelling. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Like, House of the Dragon, a show that I think is legitimately great.
Yeah.
Rings of Power, a show that I had a lot of fun with. Now, were I to sit in week to week, tear it apart with Dave Chen, like, would I feel differently?
Would I want to still do this podcast with him? Probably not.
No, David, you told me you hated that show. We don't got to cover it. We'll just do the first episode. We're good. Yeah, yeah. We're good.
I will say I got the stat wrong, Patrick Lepik. It wasn't 60% of the people got to the end.
It was 80%.
It was 60% of the people didn't get to the end. It was 37% of viewers got to the end of the first season. So I'm going to say, I assume that's why Amazon hasn't announced the next season yet, is because they want to see how season two goes before they sink another, I'm going to guess conservatively, $200 million into season three. So time will tell, but you're right. This year it will be interesting, and we have not figured out what our coverage plan for that is. I'm certainly open to having Don Marshall back on the show, who's a Lord of the Rings expert, to talk about it. But I'm also liking this.
Did Don like it?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Right. Just trying. I didn't listen. Yeah, to, I'm just trying to get know. A sense.
Yeah, you're just trying to get a sense.
Finger to the air.
Yeah. Anyway, Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, season 3 coming soon. Finally, here's a fun one, Patrick Lepik. The Sopranos finale diner booth has sold on, I think it was eBay, actually. 4 days on eBay. So for those who don't know, spoilers for the series finale of The Sopranos. Patrick Lepik, I am a huge fan of Sopranos. I've seen the whole run multiple times. I actually think the finale's brilliant. You have not seen the whole show. You've seen a couple seasons, but you are familiar with what happens in the finale. Right?
I am, yes.
So we're going to spoil the finale of The Sopranos, but in the final scene of The Sopranos, Tony Soprano is having dinner with his family at Holston's in New Jersey. Let me make sure I got this right. Holston's, the Broomfield, New Jersey ice cream parlor. And he's having dinner with his family, and everything seems to be going okay, but like something's not quite right. There's suspicious figures lurking around. Maybe one of them wants to do him harm. And Journey's Don't Stop Believing plays in the background, and all of a sudden, when the singer sings the words "Don't Stop," the show cuts to black. And roll credits, and that is how The Sopranos ends. It has fueled decades of speculation about what exactly that ending was supposed to mean. I would strongly suggest you read The Sopranos Sessions by Matt Zolersites and Alan Sepinwall. They have analyzed this question to death, and I am convinced that, you know, I have my own interpretation of the ending, and maybe we'll talk about that one day. But anyway, the booth that was there at the Holston's ice cream parlor was put on sale because the 88-year-old ice cream shop is being remodeled. And after 4 days on eBay, the bidding war closed at $82,600. I'm reading here from a Hollywood Reporter article, quote, "The winner doesn't just get the table and seats. For the hefty price, they receive the divider wall, which features a plaque that reads, 'This booth reserved for the Soprano family.' The tabletop jukebox used in the scene is unfortunately not included." Holston's owners also noted in a post on Instagram that they don't want to do this, but the integrity of the booths are now compromised. They have been repaired many times, and this furniture is over 60 years old. Obviously, we do not want to do this. However, it has come to the point where they are not structurally safe anymore as a whole, and we need to think of the safety of our patrons first. They also said, "We still have people coming in asking to sit in the Sopranos booth. We still get bus tours on Saturday and On Locations tour. Over the summer, you'll see people taking pictures outside and people taking pictures of the booth. It's not the frenzy it was when it happened 17 years ago, but it's still quite the popular attraction." Did I say the price already, Patrick Lepik? I may have, right?
Yes.
$82,600 is how much it sold for. Patrick Lepik, I wanted to use this opportunity just to talk about any memorabilia that we would have wanted to own or that we do own. And I'll just bring up a couple examples from my own life. All right. First of all, Patrick Lepik, you and I get sent a lot of stuff for free because we are in the industry. Is that right, by the way? Actually, I'm assuming that.
So I used to get a lot of stuff sent for free, and I've now pummeled the PR people into submission to not send me a Leon Kennedy action figure from Resident Evil 4. Although they still did. He's right here.
Wow.
Right,
Patrick here. For those who are watching the video here. Version of this, Patrick Klepek has just brandished the Leon Kennedy action figure.
It's a lot of well-meaning junk to like pre-order bonuses and stuff like that that come with games. Like I just don't have the space for it. I don't really care about stuff like that. And so I've at this point turned it down so many times that the only stuff that I still get is, and most PR people now know that I've got kids. They're like, I know you don't want the stuff, but there's like a plushie. And I'm like, oh, you can send the plushie. The plushie can come and I'll send that to one of the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will tell you one of the most like intrusive one of these is there was a very short lived show on HBO Max. It was called HBO Max at the time. That no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
Called Raised by Wolves.
Yeah. Love that first season.
And I got sent, like, the idea is that it's these androids that go onto this alien planet and they kind of they're trying to repopulate it, basically. And essentially, they stay in these, I want to say, inflatable sci-fi huts, basically, right? Like there's this big orange hut that has all the, it's like broken off into sections. It's like an inflatable hut. And somebody at the HBO Max publicity department sent me a plastic model of one of those huts.
Okay.
And that had like other cool Raised by Wolves merch in it. And it's very flimsy and it's kind of being ripped apart. And my wife has literally wanted me to throw it out since the day I received it years ago. And I still have it because the thing is, I'm like, oh, no one else has one of these. You know, like this is a one of a, or not one of a kind, but you know, probably only a few dozen or hundreds of these were made.
Right.
And even though it's a really piece of shit, crappy plastic Raised by Wolves hut for a show that no longer exists anymore, it's still a cool looking hut. That's the other thing is like Raised by Wolves was canceled. And if it had become like a hit show, maybe it would be cool. Like if millions of people were still like in the
you
fandom,
could set that aside 10 years right. from now, maybe somebody would want this.
I could bond with people over it. Like I could have people over my house and point at the Raised by Wolves little hut and, you know, and say, hey, you know, it's quite a thing, isn't it? You know, and they would nod and say yes and think I was cool like that. But I can't
Rob,
have any
Rob,
of that anymore.
You have no other route to this. You put all the money on this Raised by Wolf promo item.
Yeah. Okay, so that's an example of like a free movie or TV show memorabilia. Much more recently, Succession ended, and there was a massive auction. Do you remember that? There's a massive auction.
This happens for a lot of these shows. Yeah. I've perused through some of them and wondered. What if I had more money? And then I closed the tab.
Yeah, and I really wanted to buy stuff. Like, I really seriously considered buying stuff. But it was just so expensive because Succession is a show that attracts rich people. So, for instance, looking at the New York Times story about this, there is a Dodrick, in the first episode of Succession, Dodrick is the mascot for the Waystar Royco theme park. And Cousin Greg gets in a Dodrick outfit and throws up through the eye holes of the outfit, right? So that is it's basically a dog costume. It cost $7,800. It went for $7,800 at auction. One of the characters in the show carries a boxy Burberry bag to a party, and Tom Wamsgams refers to it as ludicrously capacious. That sold for $18,750. And there was a few items that were like a few thousand dollars, but they were like so not... like, it'd be like, oh, here's a Tom's Wamsgam's fake Waystar Royco badge card, right? That like he uses to badge into the office. And it's like, kind of cool, but do I really want to spend $2,000 on a Succession badge? I couldn't do it, Patrick Klepek. I couldn't do it. I really wanted to, but anyway, basically, I have the heart of somebody who would buy a Sopranos booth for $82,000, but I don't have the bank account of that person. Patrick Klepek, you ever bought any TV or movie memorabilia?
No, I stole one once, though.
Wow, that's not surprising at all.
years and years and years, years ago, when 24 was still in its heyday. Now I got you interested.
Yes, absolutely.
They
now
made 24 the video game for the PlayStation 2, probably an Xbox as well.
Oh my God.
At the time I was, junior in college. There was an old video show called The One Up Show. It was a very pioneering video podcast. These days, yes. If you like watching people sitting around in front of a camera talking about video games, like a lot of that goes back to this show called The One Up Show from a couple of decades.
Hugely, hugely influential to me. It is very possible to say that I might have never gone into podcasting if it wasn't for the One Up Show or the accompanying audio podcast One Up Yours. So I need to pay homage. Like David Chen might never have become a podcaster were it not for what Patrick Klepek's talking about right now. Okay.
And I was in that orbit. A lot of those people were my friends, early colleagues on the internet, and they called me and you're like, hey, you like 24, right? And I was like, do you want to go to LA, go interview the cast and for us ostensibly around this game? I was like, yeah, sure. That sounds like a great time. So I went out, I turned 21 that weekend. I hadn't started because it happened that weekend. I was coming there for my 21st birthday, and who is now my wife, the mother of my two children. We hadn't started dating yet. But I knew she was a massive, massive Kiefer Sutherland fan. And I always had a crush on her, but she was sort of off limits. That's a whole nother, we can have another podcast about this. But
absolutely. And we will.
I'd done the interviews, met Kiefer Sutherland, met Elisha Cuthbert, did all that. And then the next day was you get to go to the set and talk to a bunch of the directors of the show, producers, writers. And then we just got to be in CTU, like in the set that they were using to film whatever season was at the time. And there was
those who don't know, CTU stands for Counterterrorism Unit, a fictional government organization. Anyway, yep, go ahead.
And there was downtime where they're like, hey, you can just walk around. And the rule was, don't be an asshole. And so, like, I got to go into President Logan's, presidential room, sit in the chair. Mm-hmm. They're like, you can touch the desks. Like, you can just, you know, be cool. And so I was being cool and I was walking around. And then I thought to myself, like, wow. Well, she wasn't my wife. And that's how I think of her in my head now. My wife would really enjoy, like, I was like, what could I take from the set of 24?
Oh my God.
That would be completely innocuous. Because I didn't want to be an asshole, but I wanted to take something from the set. And
I think those are really incompatible viewpoints, by the way. I just want to put that out there.
Statute of limitations is up. I did not sign anything. Mm-hmm. They were just like, come at me, 20th Century Fox. I mean, Disney, figure it out. And I'm sitting in Kiefer Sutherland's Jack Bauer's desk. Looking around, like touching things, taking some pictures. I happened to move something aside, and it was just a little holder of paper clips. And there's tons of paper clips in here, like 30, 40, 50 paper clips. Who would miss a paper clip, David Chen? Who would miss? I mean, maybe a continuity editor, but that I'm keeping them on their toes, David. Mm-hmm. I'm keeping them on their toes. And so
that's not that. If you had said a pen, I would actually, I think, like, once it reaches level of pen, I would say that's not cool.
Yeah, I looked at a pen, but there was only a couple, and it's like these could be distinctive or used.
Yes.
Paperclip.
Okay,
so
I think that's probably okay. Unless unless there's like a close-up shot of like the desk, and then, you know, the set dress is going to be like, whoa, I had 18 paper clips exactly. Who took one of them?
Jack Bauer is supposed to use his paper clip against one of the terrorists when they broke into CTU for the seventh time.
You're the reason why the nuke goes off, Patrick Klepek. So I want to say season 3. Is that right?
I think that is right. So I took two. I took one for a good buddy of mine. I took
you took
one.
Two paper clips.
I did take two paper clips.
One was okay, but two, I don't know. Yeah,
and I took the other, and my wife actually made it into a necklace and like hung it around her neck for a while when we first started dating, and she still has it. Nice. Upstairs.
It's nice
somewhere.
That your love is based off of theft. That's very sweet.
That's called passion. David, I am the beholder.
Here's my big takeaway is don't invite Patrick Klepek somewhere and ask him to not be an asshole. That's kind of where that's where I'm coming down on this one.
The other thing I have does not involve theft. Taking beach sand.
It involves wire fraud and an $82,000 payment for a Sopranos booth on eBay.
Lost is probably my all-time favorite show, maybe only eclipsed by like The Leftovers in recent years. Somebody went to one of the main beaches, like the central beach you see like in the pilot. Mm-hmm. Like it is a beach in Oahu that you can go visit. Around the time when they're wrapping up filming that show, somebody went there and like scooped up some of the sand, like that was from the same era that they were shooting the show, put it in a little capsule and like packaged it up and shipped it to me and said like, hey, like I'm a resident out here. I went over there after they're wrapping up shooting and like took some of the sand because I know how much the show means to you. And that one I still have like up on a shelf in a prominent spot because that show also means a lot to me. So
that's nice. That's nice. But what I'm hearing is you wouldn't pay for any of this shit.
Wanted to, but like when they sold the Lost stuff, I was in my 20s and like going like month to month on paying rent in Los Angeles, making peanuts for video game websites. And so did I have $16,000 to pay for the Swan Hatch? No. Do I have that now? Yes, but I'm not allowed to spend it. So that goes to a college fund instead for my children.
I imagine it must be nice to be rich enough to buy this stuff. Like, I would love to be rich enough where I could be like, yes, I'm going to spend $3,000 on Kendall Roy's nail clippers. You know, that would be real sweet. But then I try to play out what the next step of that would be, and I have difficulty. Like, what do you do after that? You put it in a display case in your voluminous living room. Like,
you got to explain it to
people. And then you invite people over, and then you explain, like, what is... I guess rich people just like having things. Like, they don't even need to display it, right? They just like... The fact that I have it hidden in the closet somewhere on a shelf, that's good enough. But for me, I'm like, there's no point to owning it. Basically, I feel like there's no point to owning it unless you can talk about it or show it off somehow.
I agree.
And then it's like, you know, then you feel like a tool in that situation, right? Like for showing off, or you'd need like so many items that it would become a museum. And anyway, I can't get myself there, man. I can't get myself there.
That's me either.
What I'm saying is I literally can't even dream of a scenario where I would own this stuff because so. Anyway,
they'd made a PlayStation 2 Succession video game, David, and then I could have just gone to that set and helped you out.
Yeah, you're like, here's a Roman Roy's jockstrap. No one's going to miss this.
There were two of them, David. There was a whole pile.
Your wife wore a paperclip around her neck? Like, did she get it, like, soldered together or something? Because feels like it could easily just fall off, you know?
She did something to make it so it was it was firmly attached. We were falling in love, David. You do, you know, she wear that paperclip.
That's nice. She must have been really excited. She's like...
She's very excited. Like, it's, again, when I gave it to her... We were not even close to a thing yet. There's a good chance.
So I want to talk me through this. Like you're not boyfriend girlfriend. It sounds like are you dating?
No. She was just there for my 21st birthday because I, one of her or her brother is and has been one of my best friends, and as a result, his close friends were instructed you're not allowed to date my sister, and then. When I broke up with my longtime girlfriend, she told her brother, I've had a crush on that motherfucker for years, but the opportunity is here. I will pounce. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I think I put it over the edge with the paperclip. Not knowing what I was contributing to in terms of how that was going to change the rest of my life.
So I think what you're saying is this 24 CTU paperclip may have changed the course of your existence.
We don't have time for this, but I've run into Kiefer Sutherland two different. He gave me drinking advice one time. I high fived him in the bathroom after he touched his dick because he was super drunk. We don't have time to get into all of these stories. We can get into these other 24 stories another time. I got a whole bunch of them. We can.
That'll be a bonus. A bonus episode series of Decoding TV. All right, but anyway, well, that is a bunch of television news for you right here on Decoding TV.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, Patrick Klepek, it's time to get to the part of the podcast where we talk about specific television episodes. This week, we're going to be discussing Shogun Episode 3, Tomorrow and Tomorrow. We're also going to be discussing The Regime Episode 1, which is entitled Victory Day. We will start by sharing our overall thoughts on each of these things and then dive into spoiler-filled recaps. I do want to also call out for next week, the homework is Shogun Episode 4. We're covering that week to week. I will say we are not going to be covering The Regime after this week for reasons you'll hear discussed. And also, we are going to be talking about the first episode or two of The Gentlemen, which is premiering on Netflix. Probably by the time you hear this, it will be on Netflix. So The Gentlemen, the new Guy Ritchie series based off the Guy Ritchie movie, that is next week, is Shogun Episode 4 and The Gentlemen premiere. So look forward to that. All that said, let's get to our conversation about Shogun Episode 3.
My lord is famous for his trickery.
What happens if he's found?
He will be killed, and all of us.
God be with you. You'll lead him.
Patrick Klepek, let's talk about Shogun Episode 3, Tomorrow and Tomorrow. We'll start with overall thoughts and then dive into a spoiler-filled recap. What'd you think of this episode, Patrick Klepek?
Really enjoyed it. For what is kind of a transition episode, it feels like. There are still some great set pieces, great character moments. It's I think after how much was packed into those first two episodes, almost anything is going to feel like it's ratcheting back a little bit, but it really feels like it's an episode that is transitioning a lot of the pieces on the board. But so I can understand if some people feel this episode as kind of a come down from the first two, but I still really enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching these pieces go into place. And I think there's enough going on, especially where this episode goes by the end, that I couldn't help but remain thrilled by everything that's happening so far.
I thought it was solid. You know, it's interesting to hear you describe it that way. I actually think there was arguably more action in this episode than in the first two episodes. But honestly, that's why I didn't like it as much as the first couple episodes. Give me more scenes of guys talking in rooms, please, is what I'm looking for in this show. Give me people plotting to take out other people in rooms. That's kind of what I really, really enjoyed about the first couple episodes.
Agreed.
I really like the political intrigue more. You know, the action in this episode is very competent. Like, I don't think it's bad or anything, with one minor exception. But I think the political drama, the machinations, that's what I really loved about the first couple episodes. And there's a little bit of that in this one. But this is mostly one long extended set piece. So let's talk about some of the stuff that happens in this episode. Torinaga decides he needs to get out of Osaka because they're probably going to sentence him to death. So he enlists in the help of Yabushige to smuggle him out. Yabushige initially thinks Torinaga has invited him to have him killed, but instead Torinaga gives Yabushige what Yabushige wants, which is the Suruga province to expand his fief, in exchange for Yabushige transporting a bunch of people that Torinaga wants out of the area and to Ajiro. I think there was a scene in this episode where Yabushige is writing a will. I think I understood that correctly. Was that your interpretation?
I think so,
there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because can you imagine you're meeting your boss and you're like, I got to make sure my will's ready for your boss, you know? That would be a little stressful, a little anxiety provoking, I might imagine. But yeah. Anyway, any thoughts on any of the opening components of this episode, Patrick Klepek?
You know, it's interesting, you know, the bit about the will, because, I mean, this is not a world of computers and like you just rip that up. Like, who knows? Like, oh, great, you wrote that. Like, you know, like it doesn't matter. But I think part of what I find so fascinating about
honor system, Patrick Klepek.
Well, that's what I mean. System, that's what like I mean. Truly, like it's so much of the show is watching how long can cultural norms withstand like the tensions at the heart of the show. Like so much of like what you're watching are people following historical cultural norms and then just being pressed and like what forces them to try something different. And so I think it's fascinating to watch little moments like that. I enjoyed it as well, just because you're constantly reminded of this society's norms. And then part of like the thrust of what we get to watch is, well, what happens when, you know, what happens when a white guy's thrown into the mix? But like what's you know, but yeah. It's obviously more right. than that, but it's what happens when these people are pressed to question like these norms, why we do them. But you still write a will, like you still put that down. And whether that's for just for his own edification of how he'd want his legacy to be, or if, I don't know, I assume even if they had chosen to kill him, they would have tried to respect his
absolutely.
Wishes.
Absolutely. But yeah, it's just a sign that he doesn't know if Torunaga is going to be displeased or if Torunaga might know that he's playing both sides, which he continues to be in this episode. Anyway, Yabushige has Blackthorn, Mariko, and Mariko's husband, Buntaro, as well as Lady Kiri, who is Torunaga's wife, and also Fuji, who is the woman whose baby and husband were killed in the first couple episodes. They join this convo that starts in Osaka and leaves for Ajiro. And right as they're about to get going, Ishido, one of the five regents, appears. He starts inspecting the convoy just to make sure everything's on the up and up. And he finds that it basically is when a diversion occurs and then Torunaga is secretly subbed in for, I think it's Lady Kiri that he goes in for, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, that's then, you know, they're about to get out of the gates when they need to do another inspection. And then that's when the opening clip of the episode played. That's when Blackthorn steps in and makes himself useful for once and uses his foreignness as a weapon mm-hmm. to get them to kind of not check all the carriages and therefore discover Torunaga and murder them all. First genuinely good, useful thing that Blackthorn has done, I think, other than kind of tell Torunaga what's going on with the Portuguese bases. But I thought that whole scene was hilarious, and Cosmo Jarvis's performance is amazing, and I just thought a great sequence, tense sequence. It's not like super surprising how it plays out, but I still thought it was great. Any other thoughts, Patrick Klepek?
First of all, I guess it took me by surprise that the husband also died. I took the scene when they kill, like when they kind of close the shutters and where it's implied that the child is going to die. I guess I didn't put together that also my boy was also out the window as well, but I guess
no,
I'm not
he was the first. Yeah. Like, cause he offered to commit seppuku and right, end his family's line. So he would have been the primary. And he wanted to die, I think, yeah. And they give, they give her the remains in these little boxes, and
very,
very sad.
I think Cosmo Jarvis does a great job of oscillating between just this really flamboyant, unlikable jackass, and then like at multiple times, like in this episode, in the first two episodes. You know, like you can't, is he turning another leaf? Like, is there you get the sense that there is a broken person under there. And a lot of the, what we see, a lot of the bravado is this facade to hide the fact that we don't know much about his past, his family.
We learn a little bit more in this episode.
We learn a little bit more in this episode, but I suspect there's a lot of tragedy there. There's a lot of sadness there. And so I think that helps explain how he moves between those two worlds with such fluidity, because I think they exist in an interesting duality. And that scene ends up in a place that's pretty expected. But I think, again, this is a show using language and the complexities and the confusion of language in really interesting ways. And I thought that was a great confluence of Jarvis's like great acting skills, like combined with the specific ways this show is like kind of weaponizing language, kind of both at the viewer, but then also mm-hmm. within the show's storytelling itself.
Because because part of that scene is him shouting at, I think it's Ishiro's men in a language they don't understand, right?
Right.
And that creates a variable that they're not used to dealing with. A couple of observations about Blackthorn, and then I want to also talk about the language a little bit more. I think that Blackthorn's character, what I appreciate about how this character has changed over the first three episodes is I would say he now understands the balance of power, right? And he didn't before. He's like, you must do this, you must do that. And my reaction was, you do not understand the balance of power right now. You think you have all these cards to play. You're lucky to make it out of this alive. And he didn't seem to understand that. And he finally does seem to understand the precarious situation he's in. And he's acting accordingly. And I really like that. But also, obviously, he's gaining respect for these people who he considered savages, because he has a closer look at the things that they're doing and their customs. And I think he's growing in that way as well. And so those are things that I appreciate. I am curious how white savory this show is going to feel, not having read the novel. You know, I think there's a real risk that it goes into white savory tropes, but so far it has avoided those because Blackthorn is a pawn in these characters' game thus far. And that's like 80 to 90% of his role.
Right. His advantages are not, I have brought the secret weaponry to turn.
Right.
I mean, maybe he has.
It might be heading that way, right? But we don't know.
Not because he shows up around the corner and, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's to your point. It's a pawn. The advantages he brings are sort of like structural and contextual for, like, who he is and what he represents, as opposed to like someone coming to save the day. But I do share your, especially because you start to wonder, like, is this like a developing love interest that, like, is going on? Like,
which I'm
like,
not
laid
not
it on pretty thick. I don't love that part of it. And I'm hoping a show that is seemingly this smart, if it goes in that direction, is going to do so with some complexity and
you don't like it probably for the same reasons I don't like it, because it'd be very cliche to have white dude coming into this culture and then this beautiful woman falls in love with him.
Yes.
And, you know, like, we've seen that story many times. But what I like about Shogun so far is that it seems to be kind of eschewing that, because it's spending so much time with the other Japanese characters. Like, they're given a ton of interiority. They have their own motivations. They have their own things that they want done. You know, to use an example of a white savior trope, I would say Avatar, the James Cameron movie. Like, we spend very little time with the Na'vi outside of Jake Sully's interactions with them. You know, it's kind of, you're experiencing the world of the Na'vi through Jake Sully, and that's kind of what Avatar is. Whereas this is, like, huge portions of the episode, they don't have Blackthorn at all.
He's not a POV character.
I don't know. I think maybe in this episode, I'm not sure if he is, but if he is, he's one of several. Let's put it that way.
Sure, right? Like, I don't think he's necessary. Like,
he's not necessarily primary.
We're putting in this white savior character to act as the singular lens through which the audience is then going to, like, receive the information of
the show. Exactly. Yeah, I would agree with that. Anyway, on the point of language, I do just want to bring up that last week we talked about how smart the use of Japanese was. And we also talked about how when characters say, I'm about to speak Portuguese to you, then they speak in English.
Mm-hmm.
And is that, you know, somebody DM'd me today and asked, is that problematic? And I think you could certainly make the case that that's problematic, for sure, because they're essentially erasing the Portuguese from the show. At the same time as that's true, I'm so curious, like, why that's the case, and we can look into this, and maybe there have been interviews given, so, like, I'll try to come back with an answer for this in the next couple weeks. But I think probably on a practical level, it's very difficult to get people who can speak both Portuguese and Japanese and have them in an American production. Like, I think maybe having one was already a massive lift, and then just having both was too much from either a logistics standpoint or a marketing standpoint. Not excusing it, I'm just trying to speculate why they chose the path they did.
The way I have chosen to interpret it is that, look, at the end of the day, this show costs a lot of money. Like, you're airing it for an English audience primarily, right? Like, yeah, that's like, but it's a story about Japan. And so, yeah, what they chose to do was to, and I think you see this in the way they display the language, have the language spoken, like they don't make the Japanese characters speak English. They don't have them jump through any of those hoops, even though we have actors on screen
who can speak English.
Who I've watched speak English in other shows this year that we've talked about on this podcast. And so I think it could be both. It could be like a practically, like, can you find the right people to accomplish this goal? I also think practically to get this show made for the, they chose, if you have to find a vehicle for English in some way for this show to land or to be signed off on, they seem to have found, like, they got Japanese actors, they're speaking Japanese. Like, I think they've shown a lot of respect for what is the primary vehicle in the show, which is Japan, the Japanese people. And so I don't blame someone that was like, gosh, I really wish I could see Portuguese more properly represented. Hear you, feel
Absolutely,
you.
Yeah.
I just feel like in the practical realities of the hierarchy of what this show
is
centralizing. Like, I think if they had to, they probably chose correctly in heightening the emphasis on the Japanese.
It is weird that there's never any acknowledgement of how they handle Portuguese in the show. Like, again, like, they're speaking in Portuguese, Portuguese. The camera swings around and then they're speaking in English. But, like, that doesn't make any I can understand why that would be more confusing, because then it's like, well, why are we only hearing English for the Portuguese and not for the Japanese? So they just were like, we're just going to go with it, and it's going to be weird for the first episode or two, and then hopefully no one talks about it again.
But they also do other tricks, right? Like the sequence where Blackthorne has the priest interpreter, and he's talking to Toranaga, and then eventually the interpretation stop, and it's just cutting between Toranaga and Blackthorne. And so they smartly, and maybe you can feel like that sometimes it's more successful than others, like, use cutting and camera techniques to, like, get you to where they want to go with the language. And I can certainly see criticism in that, but I do see real intentionality and care into trying to make that feel naturalistic sure.
All right. So anyway, Yabushige is heading off to Ajiro with a whole convoy of people that Toranaga wants, and also, unbeknownst to everyone, Toranaga himself. All of a sudden, they're in the middle of the forest, and Lord Kiyama attacks the convoy, and there's like a big fight sequence breaks out, probably one of the bigger fight sequences that happened in the show. What do you think? Any thoughts on this one? I thought it was all right, you know? I didn't think it was like spectacular. I would describe it as very competent. At one point, Mariko gets in on the action and just starts cutting people down. And that's cool. And it was cool to see these folks, you know, wielding bow and arrow and shooting people through the dark and stuff like that. It was solid. It was solid. But it wasn't, I didn't think it was like, wow, incredible. This episode just had so much action to do. I felt like they got all the action done competently, but very little of it stood out as like, oh, that was spectacular to me personally. Patrick Klepek, you have a different reaction?
No, I'm with you, and I think it's weighed down even comparatively because of how spectacular the assassination sequence is.
It was so good.
Episode, right? Right?
I mean, to be fair, not a very expensive sequence, right? It's just a woman storming Toranaga's house and, like, cutting people left and right. But it was such a well-done sequence, right? So, yeah.
Well, and I think we'll have to see how the different action scenes play out in the rest of the show, but I have found the most effective violence or action in the show to be like quick, singular, and exacting. And here in this third episode, we have some of the more extended action sequences. And again, I think I'm with you. They're fine. I don't know. I found like some of the melee stuff, like a little like, wow, this camera's just lingering here and we're just watching a couple of fights. You know what I mean? I don't know. I just didn't find it like real dynamic, and it's like I think this fight scene could have been like half the length and we could have just like, you know, moved along.
Well, the thing that's weirdest is cut to the, you know, the next scene and they're at the port with the boat, and I was just like, oh, so they kind of like ran out of the forest and then commercial break and then they're running through the town, and it was like, wow, that was a rough transition. But anyway, Toranaga, Yabushige, Blackthorn, Mariko, they make it onto the port and onto a boat. And Ishido's men go after them. Or, I'm sorry, Kiyama's men go after them, I think. But Buntaro, who is Mariko's husband, stays behind, does something super heroic and badass, and kills a bunch of them, and then slowly goes down himself. Awesome scene. Buntaro, RIP, we hardly knew ye. I felt really bad for this character because he's clearly the undesirable man in Mariko's life, right? Like, he's not as good looking as some of the other dudes on the show. He's kind of an asshole to Mariko. And so you're kind of like, when can they get rid of that character? And I felt bad that I felt that way. And then he does something super heroic, sacrifices his life for everyone else. I thought that was kind of cool. Patrick Klepek, any thoughts?
I didn't see a body.
That's true.
I wouldn't be shocked if he ended up being kidnapped and ends up being a some sort of pawn.
I should have made that clear.
Well, no, the cinematography, through the music, like it's swelling. Everyone is sad, and you're watching him go off to the right hand side, out of frame, as dozens of enemies come at him, but we don't actually see him go down. It's I'll buy it either way, right? I'll completely buy it if we never see this character again. And he's dead. I also wouldn't be shocked if he showed up as some sort of negotiating tactic.
Completely fair. Point being, he sacrifices himself for the good of the crew. And that's it shows you that people aren't just one thing, you know? They're not just they're not just dicks to you over dinner necessarily. They can also be super badass and heroic sometimes.
Yeah. Well, right? it's really lovely where you get to see the ways that this culture shows respect to people in what might be their final moments where they where who knows how these people feel personally about him. Like, that's set aside for being able to show in this moment, like, how deeply honored these people are to watch this sacrifice in front of them. And I found that all to be very moving.
Indeed. After sailing out of Osaka, the whole crew find more of Kiyama's men in boats. So Toranaga's crew approaches the Portuguese black ship, which is much larger and therefore can withstand these boats, and he negotiates a passage through the harbor. Toranaga offers them a bunch of silver and allows for a church in Edo in exchange for the priests getting the regents Ono and Kiyama onto his side. The captain of the black ship also says, "You're leaving Blackthorn behind. I don't want that guy on the ship." So the priests also give Toranaga the book with all the terrible things Blackthorn has done. And anyway, that's the agreement. Blackthorn is left behind on the smaller, crappier ship. But through his sailing powers, he's able to evade Kiyama's men. And Rodriguez, who is on the Portuguese ship, he has a chance to kill Blackthorn, but he decides to spare his life because Blackthorn spared Rodriguez's life earlier, and one good turn deserves another. Again, totally solid action scene. And some of the water stuff actually looked pretty good, I would say.
Yeah.
But
helps when it's dark.
I do appreciate that they found a little character motivation for why Rodriguez behaves the way he does, right? Like, it's just cool that, hey, already the show's setting stuff up a couple episodes ago, paying it off now. I feel like the storytellers were in good hands. Anything else about this stuff before we get to the end here?
No. I thought that was a fun sequence. I thought that to some degree, I couldn't really. It was hard to tell what exactly Blackthorn was trying to pull off. Like, I was like, they're real close. What's he trying to do? I don't know. Like, some of the setup of the visuals didn't wholly work for me in terms of understanding the geography until the rock showed up. And then I had a good sense of what we were trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
I think much like the rest of the action, it was fine.
Excuse me, Patrick, did you not hear me when I said he's using the power of sailing? Anyway,
I saw him kick his feet real hard.
We get a scene with the regents arguing, and this is like so awkward, right, Patrick Lepic? Don't you hate it when you're like, I want to kill this guy, and then your other coworkers are like, no, let's do this other thing for, like, let's kill this other guy first, then we can kill your guy, but then they end up not killing the guy first, and basically they end up killing neither guy.
As a result of podcasting setup.
It's just such a... I hate it when that happens. And so everyone's pissed because it's like neither of them got to kill the guy they wanted to kill. Huge bummer. And Hiromatsu, Toranaga's friend, shows up with a message that Toranaga has resigned from the council. And then Ishido's like, well, fine, we can vote 4-0. and decide to kill Torunaga that way. And then he's like, I think you got to check the bylaws. You cannot vote unless you have five regents. Which is a genius move.
Did anyone else, was everyone else, was he just hoping no one else had read the bylaws? Like, I don't think the other regents. You know what I mean? Like,
I am shocked at Ishido's lack of bylaws knowledge. Put it that way. But yeah, now, you know, and it's like, okay, well, they can probably get someone to be the fifth regent, but that would mean giving a lot of power to some other person that they don't know right now. And mm-hmm. so it puts them in a very uncomfortable situation. Well done, Hiromatsu and also Torunaga. Well played. Game recognized game. The episode ends with Torunaga taking his galley, his ship, to Edo and instructing his son to stay with Yabushige to train a new regiment. So I'm very curious how the Torunaga son plus Yabushige dynamic is going to work out. Torunaga presents Blackthorn with proof of his own piracy, but implies that he's willing to overlook his terrible history in exchange for his help. And Blackthorn is giving a new name, Hatamoto, which is a great honor to be given a name in this society. Torunaga also asks Blackthorn to teach him how to dive. Now, I want to hear your thoughts on this diving scene, Patrick Klepek, but I do just also want to mention that one other component about the Blackthorn storyline is that this whole situation gives him a chance to have a new start. And I think we see that with the, like, there's all these symbolic things about having a new start. Here's a book. It's going to probably vanish and no one will ever see it again. Here's a new name. Like, you have a new kind of identity and it's a chance to reinvent himself. And that's exciting, especially given that Blackthorn seemed like a raging asshole that was also a bad person that had done horrible things in the past. But Patrick Klepek, this diving scene was something that you really appreciated. Tell us why.
I just thought it was a really beautiful, as we get to, again, this whole notion of culture clashes, language clashes, trying to communicate, for these two characters to arrive at this really emotional, defining moment for themselves, and the way they found a way to kind of, you know, the definition of masculinity and machismo in Japanese culture, how it's depicted, is like, you know, fundamentally different than how we would think about it in American culture. But like, there's still sort of this stoic kind of bad, like standoffishness. And I loved the idea of just like whipping
a formality, basically.
Yeah. And this idea of like this loop of like doing the dive, and then when he gets up and says, like, you know, ask him for the race, and they dive in together, and, you know, we know bad things are ahead. I do not think this is a show chock full of happy moments, and it seems like more people are going to die, and there's going to be a lot of sadness ahead as this conflict plays out.
How dare you assume, Patrick Klepek? Maybe the show could be like The Curse and surprise you. You know, who knows?
But I don't know. I just found that really touching between two people who are like just so rigid and found a way to connect with one another, despite having so very little in common. And that little bit at the end where they jumped into, I was rooting for his form. I was like, oh, please don't belly flop. Please don't belly about Torunaga. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Of course he nailed it. I just found that to be a really nice, like, I think that brings these first three episodes to a really,
yeah, yeah,
nice. It feels like
if the show ended here, that would have been awesome. But it's not gonna.
It feels like the first arc of the show is coming to a conclusion, and I couldn't really tell you what's gonna happen next. Like, it feels like it has put a period on. This is where we're at with these characters and these plot lines, and your guess is as good as mine on where the pieces pick up next week.
Indeed. Well, anyway, those are some of our thoughts on Shogun Episode 3, Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Solid episode. Patrick Klepek, before we move on, you want to let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me talking about video games over at remapradio.com, and I have my newsletter about parenting and gaming over at crossplay.news.
Very cool. And I just want to remind people, next week on Decoding TV, we'll be covering the next episode of Shogun. We'll also be covering The Gentleman on Netflix, based on the Guy Ritchie movie. Patrick Klepek, let's talk about The Regime.
Happy Victory Day, madam.
Let's get on with it, please. Yes.
ravishing. The flowers are ravishing.
I just need to be brief for these briefings.
Madam Chancellor, Corporal Zubak. Not nice what they're calling you, butcher. There's a good man in there who deserves love.
The Chancellor has a bit of an infatuation.
He's not dangerous, is he?
She'll lose interest, she always does.
A heart.
What if this time she doesn't?
I'd love to smash their faces. Anyone who makes you weak.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
All right, Patrick Klepek, let's discuss The Regime, which is now on Max, the one to watch for HBO. You can stream it there. In one sentence or less, Patrick Klepek, do you think people should watch The Regime?
Oh, sorry. That's just a podcast. No, despite a deep love for Kate Winslet, I found The Regime to fall pretty flat and be pretty boring, and I will not be watching more of it.
That is so brutal. I think this might be the farthest apart we've ever been on a show. Like, here's the thing. I did not love the show. I don't think it's brilliant or amazing or anything like that, but it certainly has enough to keep me engaged. And again, Kate Winslet is an MVP here. So I think it's a political satire. And I think I don't find the satire to be particularly biting yet, but the show looks amazing.
Does.
Like it's one of the most beautiful shows on television, I think. And Kate Winslet is always really compelling. And so those two things are enough to keep me watching. Whether the show will end up saying something really meaningful is TBD for me, but I still think there's more to recommend it than not. So those are my overall thoughts on the show. Let's talk about some of the stuff that happens in the first episode of The Regime. We're going to spoil the plot of the first episode, Victory Day. The Regime takes place in a fictional country located in Middle Europe that has an economy largely built on its cobalt reserves. Elena, who's played by Kate Winslet, is a quasi-despotic ruler who is also super paranoid about her health. In the first episode, Elena prepares for Victory Day, a celebration of Elena's triumphant election over the previous administration. She's hired a soldier named Zubak, played by Matthias Schoenaerts, to help her take humidity readings throughout her house. While Zubak embarrasses Elena at a meeting with dignitaries, he eventually saves her from a possible assassin and becomes part of her inner circle. The episode ends with him forcing out several members of Elena's inner circle, presumably condemning them to sad ends and cementing his own position. So, you know, Patrick Klepek, I thought about this tweet I read a really long time ago when I was watching the show, which was talking about billionaires. And it was about how it must be very odd to be a billionaire because you can literally get anything you want. Like, literally any desire you have of any kind.
Anything from the Succession set. It's yours!
anything from the set of the HBO series Succession, you can buy. But... Like literally, like any type of food, any animal, any object of sexual fetish, like anything you can have can be.
There's no wants. They're just whims.
They're just whims. And I remember somebody tweeting, like, it must be so weird to be a billionaire because you can just have everything. And they said, cognitively, it's probably similar to being kicked in the head every day. and I always thought about that because I feel like Kate Winslet plays Elena, who is this ruler who basically has dozens, hundreds, thousands, millions of people like catering to her every whim. And if that's the case, you'd probably ask for more things than you would if that was not the case, yeah. Right? Uh-huh, uh-huh. And so she gets everything she wants, like a guy who's holding a hygrometer to walk around and making sure her house is at a low enough humidity. She gets dehumidifiers set up all over the house because she's afraid, you know, her father had health problems. She is deathly afraid of her own health problems. And so as a result, yeah, like the whole house bends to her will. And, you know, that's part of the satire. I thought that was like interestingly conveyed. But you know what? Honestly, Patrick Klepek, did you ever see that movie, The Menu?
Yeah, love it.
Really fun movie. Really, really well done movie. This The Regime is created by one of the writers of The Menu.
Hmm.
I had a great time with The Menu, but ultimately, I don't know that The Menu was a particularly deep experience, right? Like, it's The Menu is a blast. Like, I would recommend it. Go watch The Menu. I had so much fun watching The Menu, but characters don't really change that much during that movie. You know, like, there's no real arcs for any of the characters during the movie. It's like, hey, here's a fun kind of trick we're playing on the audience, or a fun little game, and then we get to the end of the game, and then the game is over, and that's it. That's it. And there's a little bit you can think of more deeply that happens in the movie, but like, I don't think it's that deep of a movie. It's fun. It's a blast. I don't think it's that deep. And I kind of having a similar struggle with The Regime, right? And I've read some reviews that kind of have a similar complaint, which is, does this show have anything to say beyond having lots of power sometimes makes you bad? Right? Like, does the show have anything deeper to say than that? I think it's going to be hard for the show to do that because it takes place in a fictional country. You know, like, it's not like it's referring to specific real world events. Patrick Klepek, how biting did you find the political satire of The Regime? I mean, you had a much more basic issue, which is you literally had difficulty getting through the episode because you found it to be not that interesting, right?
Yeah, but I think it's that it speaks to all those elements, right? So I think I don't think the lack of it being based on a real country is necessarily a flaw, but it does mean you have a hill to overcome, which is, how do I latch on to what's here? And so it's got to invent that for you from whole cloth, and hopefully that's enough. And I don't think there's any reason to think the show couldn't get there. But for me, fundamentally, it's just the satire. It wasn't biting. It wasn't interesting. And, you know, now learning that some of the creatives were, you know, attached to The Menu, part of what makes that show work, or that movie work, despite it being kind of shallow in terms of what it's, quote, trying to say, is like, the characters are so heightened that you are mesmerized by how they were probably defined on the page and then brought to just such colorful heights by the acting. And here, I mean, Winslet has quirks. She's got, you know, some weird things that she does.
I would
does,
say they're pretty, it, I would say it's moderately heightened, this show, Patrick Klepek.
But it's just, I don't know, it's mostly just her. And like everything around her doesn't really do it for me. Like, mm-hmm. the arc of where this is going, like the world that's built around her didn't really, I just couldn't find enough to like,
you can find an entryway into this world that allowed you to emotionally connect with what's going on.
Especially for the commitment of a television show, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a little, it's, you know, if it's one thing, if like, oh, we're looking at a 2.5 hour movie, I'll give it time to sort of figure itself out. Much different to say, I'm going to commit to watching, you know, 8 to 10 hours of this. It's like, if I feel so little attachment this early on, I just, the breadcrumbs were not ones I wanted to follow necessarily. And I think a lot of that had to do with a lack of the satire landing, really, is satirical. It mostly just seemed,
you're like, quirky. This is very plausible for how this could all play. This is like this is like the Don't Look Up of satires, in that it feels like exactly what would actually happen.
That seems mean to The Regime, David. right. It's like less of a lack of plausibility as much as I just found very little to latch onto in the world and the characters in a way that I was a little shocked by, because I'm usually primed for this sort of work. And I found myself charmed by Winslet, but not mesmerized. I was charmed by Winslet. I don't know that I was mesmerized by the character she was playing.
Mm-hmm,
I think that's more to do with Winslet than the show that she's in.
I didn't love the show, but I was like, oh, there's enough here to keep me watching. The show looks amazing, I think. Like I said,
yeah.
the set dressing, the you know, production design is all like really detailed and intricate. Like from how the house looks to the design of the dehumidifiers that they put everywhere, it all feels really thought through. There's so many different locations. There's the war room. There's this little private doctor's office that she has in, you know, like her own bedroom. Like, all this stuff. Sometimes in different states, like she goes into a room that has plastic covering the walls at one point, mm-hmm. and it looks incredible. So there's just all this stuff in the show that it screams amazing production values. Kate Winslet obviously does a great job as well. I find her to be a fascinating depiction.
This is the quintessential show that I need, it sounds like you're going to keep watching it. I'm super curious to see what you make of it. There was so little for me to go on in the first episode that it's the kind of show that, you know, when you are trying to spend your time, I mean, Super Earth needs saving, David. And like, do I spend that time
playing Helldivers 2, playing Helldivers 2, yeah, or watching The Regime? Yeah,
I'm so curious. I'll be curious to know, like, you found enough to keep going. I need to hear it from someone else to be like, yeah, hey, I know this didn't work for you, but the parts that did work for you, whoa, they really like find interesting things to do with it. I'm sort of unwilling to invest that time myself, but I'm deeply curious where you land on it as you go forward to see if there's enough.
Well, let's just talk about one other component of the show before we kind of wrap up here. Herbert Zubak is this guy who was part of this terrible mining tragedy, mm-hmm, and then is brought into and presumably murdered people. Like, that's kind of the implication, is that he murdered a bunch of people is kind of what the implication is. And for reasons that are not clear to the viewer, he is brought into work for Elena, right? And I actually thought that was a really great way into this. Like, he is the kind of audience surrogate into this world. And it worked. It really worked for me. But you did not connect with that character, it sounds like.
He was probably the thing that worked for me the most about the show. But he's half the show. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if only and I expect, you know, the show is certainly signaling that he is a central component, like sharing the stage with Winslet to a large degree. But I find all of that part of it really, and it's, you know, it's made very clear that, hey, like, a huge subplot of the show is going to be what happened in this mine. What are the consequences of that? And I'm, you know, I guess I'm, you know, I was interested, but I just didn't find, there are lots of individual pieces that I was like, oh, huh, that's interesting. I just didn't find that it all sort of stitched together in a way that, mm-hmm, painted a portrait for me.
I also just find the way Kate Winslet's character communicates with everyone to be quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. She has this kind of very maternalistic, do you love me? I love you. Not just to her, the people around her, but also to her country people, like her subjects. You know, she's very like, hey, you know, very kind of like a very mommy type, love based mode of interaction. And I think that's, you know, that's interesting thing to explore, like how these people think of them. And it's very similar to other cults of personality that occur around the world and potentially in the United States. So I'm very curious to see how that's going to play out or whether that will evolve. But ultimately, I think this first episode doesn't give us that much to go on in terms of where the show is heading. But there's enough here for me to keep going and keep checking it out. There's all, you know, let's mention a couple of other things that happened this episode. I thought the scene where the guy creeps into her room at night was pretty effective. Mm-hmm. Pretty effective scene. There's a scene where she gets up and performs a song for everyone, and
that was great.
Sings extremely off key for huge parts of it, and it's like excruciating, right? And then when Zubak, like, what happens is when people like Zubak and other people behave as she has instructed them to, like by serving lamb or meat at dinner, or by saying, you know, don't touch, preventing her from touching others, or showing her what the humidity reading is, when he does that around other people, she blows up at them, right? And there's this kind of volatility that is always under the surface. It's kind of like, you remember that episode of Twilight Zone with a little boy that could, you know, kill people with his mind, right? Mm-hmm. And so everyone's kind of like trying to assuage him and make sure, like, he's happy. There's something very childlike about a lot of these leaders, because on the one hand, they're very emotionally immature. On the other hand, they can murder people on a whim. And it creates a very weird work environment. You know? That I think the show does a great job of bringing to life. I will say one other thing that's kind of not in the show's favor is Andrea Riseborough is in the show. Brilliant actor. She's doing a great job in the show. No complaints about her in the show. But she is also in another extremely similar movie to this called The Death of Stalin. Have you seen The Death of Stalin?
Yeah, great movie.
Brilliant, brilliant movie. The writing in that movie is just really sharp compared to this show. I'm not saying the show is bad, but like The Death of Stalin, every scene felt like it is brilliant. It is funny. Yeah. It is trying to say something. And this show does not feel that way. It feels like it takes its time to get to, like, a lot more time to get to where it needs to go. And so Andrew Risebo is great, but unfortunately it made me think of the death of Stalin. And that is not to the show's favor. So, okay. Any other thoughts on the show, Patrick Klepek, on the regime?
No, I like I said, I'm deeply curious to see where it lands for you going forward. And I'm rooting for it. I like a reason to keep going. Like I said, this is the kind of show that usually is my cup of tea. I love Death of Stalin. Like, these satires normally land with me, but I think, again, like, it's to that original point. If you're going to be a satire, like, the satire has to land for you. And so far, I think the point you made just earlier of it doles it out pretty slowly. And I feel like that was a huge part of my issue, was just kind of the pacing of the structure of the show. I think that contributed to my lack of interest.
Like, it takes a long time for you to be like, what are we even looking at? Like, what is this even? Yeah. Right. And I understand, but hey, it's only one episode, Patrick Klepek. Maybe you want to give it another shot. If I say to you three episodes in, Patrick, the show's brilliant, you got to get back on the ship or get back on the train, would you consider doing it?
I would get right back into the mine, David.
Okay, wow. Right back into that cobalt mine. Okay, we do not currently have plans to further cover the regime on Decoding TV, but I will continue watching and we'll check back in at some point before the show is over or possibly right after to let you know how the journey has been. All right, I think that's going to do it for us right here on Decoding TV. Let us know what you thought of any of what we've discussed, Shogun, The Regime, any of the film news. Write into us at decodingtv@gmail.com. We'd love to read your emails on the air. He is Patrick Klepek. I am David Chen. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you later.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.